Rogan, these guys, Rush Limbaugh, these are not dumb guys by any means.
Yeah. Don't listen to me. I'm a fucking idiot. Why are you listening to me?
You know, years ago, when it was, you know, when he was really at the pipe, the journalism world was always like lamenting, even as they respected Jon Stewart.
Welcome to the Daily Show. My name is Jon Stewart. We have got it.
Well, I can't believe more people get their news from the Daily Show. It's on Comedy Central. He's the first to say he's not a journalist. And so we could lament that because we all watched it and a lot of us enjoyed it. Or you could sort of say, like, what is it about the way he's given them information that they now? And guess what? If they got their news from the Daily Show, they got their news.
Welcome to Radius of Reason, a podcast about the greatest problems facing humanity. I'm Levon here with my co-host, Andre.
On the episode today, we're joined by Neil Brown. He's the president of the Poynter Institute, which is a journalism think tank focusing on education and training, and also oversees the notorious fact-checking platform, PolitiFact. Neil is a career journalist. He spent 4 decades in the profession, and he's also a former member of the Pulitzer Prize board. On the episode today, we talk about the economics of modern journalism, how journalism can compete with content creators the likes of Joe Rogan, and how the profession can survive in the era of AI. With the rise of large language models, a lot of sports journalism, for instance, has fallen victim to tools essentially reproducing articles detailing high school sports games and things like that. Some are saying that like sports journalism was the first harbinger of the automation of the press, so to speak. Do you feel that this is a step in the wrong direction? That allowing these sorts of entrails of tech to get into these core foundations of the media, is that, ultimately speaking, going to damage Americans' relationships with how the news is reported?
So I don't mean to give you whiplash, but the answer to that is no. I think a lot of these AI tools are really helpful and useful. But back to the question of definition, it doesn't necessarily mean it's journalism. So what is journalism? Journalism is independent, original reporting.
Yes.
Okay. So these AI tools, I think, have a lot of possible use, application, audience focus that can be helpful. What they're not doing particularly now is, I'm not saying someday there won't be, whether it's robotics or something else, they are not doing original reporting, meeting you on the street in Chicago or Levon in Kansas City and asking you a question or finding out where you got that microphone or who's funding you or whatever. They may scrape a variety of sources that did that. The original sources is the journalism. AI is another tool for distribution. It may be a very powerful one. It may be a good one. It's got great possibility and great opportunity for mischief.
I like that framing.
But that is not journalism.
I like that framing.
What do you think traditional journalism needs to do to compete with, you know, social media and now artificial intelligence interfaces like ChatGPT? A lot of people are now going to get their news from ChatGPT, quite frankly. You know, before they would Google things, maybe click on a couple of the first results.
Sure.
Now they're just shortcutting that with an interface. You know, with this AI oracle, basically, that knows everything, but not quite. So what can journalists do when, you know, people are always going to take the path of least resistance? We live in an ever increasingly complex world, and there's not really much room for nuance, right? People just want to ask the question, get the answer, and get out.
Yeah, and I think journalism as an industry, the media as an industry, has paid a price for being sort of slow to adapt to technological change, or resisting it, or assuming it's all bad, or that it can't work. I think, I don't mean to be too corny, but the devil's in the details, right? Mm-hmm. So the question is, if it's like you guys were giving the example, if it's to do like high school sports games, okay, here's how that would work. And that's been talked about for years, and the large language models have been experimented, and I think they can help. To cover a bunch of games, you know, through just the information, the coach plugs in the information, the tool puts it into some story form, you've got it. Now, where that can help journalism is it's quick, it's clean, nobody needs to commit an act of literature around a preps game or anything like that, right? So then can you take the savings created by that and then do a profile of the coach or of the program or of the, you know, do that original reporting I mentioned before, because you have not spent time on something that is essentially basic and a commodity. And the audience got what it needed, right? So this is a connection of the audience. I only need boom, boom, boom. The AI tool can do it. Boom, boom, boom. So now can we take the resource and either go find some funding to do more with it, to do some new and different things? Mm-hmm. So that's why I said the details matter. You know, it's not to say that people, the fact that people like information in a very clean, clinical way that AI often can provide, then don't want other kinds of information.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, or have to pick it. So where I think the journalism world has both an opportunity and a challenge is the thing that AI doesn't bring immediately, and that is imagination, right? Or creativity, right. Or human judgment, right. That we will then share. Well, here's what the human judgment is. Do you like my judgment or not? You disagree or not? It's okay. But let's not pretend it's all just the Encyclopedia Britannica in a faster lane.
Hey guys, if you're enjoying this episode, just a quick reminder to like and subscribe.
You can engage us by leaving us a comment. Let us know how we're doing. Let us know what you think about the show. And I really like that framing of AI as a potential augmentation to the work that the journalist is already doing. It does, I think, move away from, honestly, the stereotypical like doom and gloom, AI is going to replace everything, and then we're all just going to be reading like LLM swill as it's being generated.
Well, exactly.
But
and I think that I want to embrace that opportunity, not just the anxiety.
Yeah, and I think you bring up a very interesting point around how maybe some of these tools could actually assist in restoring some of the newsrooms that are cash strapped, don't have enough resources to commit to everything. But before we get into that, I think it begs the question of the existential threats faced by the journalist profession independent of AI. And I think if we set AI aside briefly, we can start getting into the multi-layered problems that the profession faces on many, many fronts. First and foremost is that it's not the same industry as it was 30 years ago. We don't have to get into the often repeated stories about smaller newspapers closing down, although there are stories of things being restored. But journalism as a profession, I'll make the case here that it's no longer a working class profession. It's no longer a situation where somebody graduates from high school and can go work as a cub reporter in a newsroom and then break out into much larger reporting opportunities, a la Ernest Hemingway and the Kansas City Star, et cetera, et cetera. Right now, it seems to me, and please feel free to chime in, that journalism is very much a profession of the elite. Top J schools in the Northeast, at Columbia, NYU. Of course, you also have Mizzou in Missouri, but the tuition for these is absolutely astronomical. And because of the smaller number of job openings, you have to have more and more credentials to make yourself competitive to get into newsrooms to begin with. So my thesis here is that somebody that's going to be a reporter at the New York Times is going to be coming from a background that's not in line with the majority of the country that's consuming the work that they're putting out. What are your thoughts on that?
So I take no issue with anything you said. In fact, I think you framed a challenge for the industry very, very well. One we can confront. What you just described is an absolute, legit, genuine problem with the journalism world and the media industry. And I think to some degree, without sounding too old-fashioned, I think back to the future is where we're headed, which is that I do believe that the answer can be to break these things down. So let's start with your phrase, working class journalism. I generally like that. I generally like that. And I think you've identified one of the problems.
That's Thomas Frank, not me, but yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I like your quotation. I think you're accurate. The thing I would say about it is I believe local is the answer. It's like all politics is local, all real journalism starts local. And I think the way we can get there, and I think your diagnosis of the cost of these J schools is just one very legitimate component. So we have been working with a couple of our sort of clients, including the Cronkite School at ASU, on possibly producing a certificate program to train individuals, maybe even second career individuals. Maybe they're veterans who want to try something new, or maybe they're working at a they're going to school at a community college, and teach them some of the craft aspects of journalism, and get them then placed in local news organizations in their community, writing stories, taking photos, taking video, doing local podcasts. To grow that, you don't have to go to Northwestern or to Missouri or somewhere like that and get those big tuitions, but you can figure out whether this is what we do. We're a training institute, whether you can, whether this journalism game is your cup of tea, right? And so whether you want to learn how to do the craft, learn how to edit, learn how to do, again, the very kind of audio work you guys are doing, and then start to do it in a local news environment where, by the way, you might actually know the people you're covering. Mm-hmm. And if you know the people you're covering, maybe then they will believe what you write or shoot, whatever it may be. Now trust goes up because we have taken this down from this macro cable TV blue-red environment onto a local level, whether you call it working class or just simply community, local. It might be small. It doesn't have to be small. It can be in a big city. But where there is a relationship between the audience, customer, and the journalist. And that would require some new and different approaches and training. I don't think it's an either or, but I do think that we can get in a moment. I'm sure in a moment we'll get into the question of influencers and content creators. I do think that there is a way to bring, whether you call it working class versus elites, I would say more like on the ground versus up in the clouds. And you can begin to bring original reporting, independent information, a relationship where you're talking about stuff that's important to your community. And then, of course, it's going to go out into some interesting thematic topics and things like that. So it's not about suddenly being small potatoes by any means, but it is about having a relationship. And if we can get journalism to do that, you're going to grow trust, you're going to grow customers. You might eventually go revenue. It's a long game. And eventually that's still going to go back to who is eventually going to get eventually hired up to the New York Times and other places like that.
Well, so you mentioned revenue. Can you just elaborate on the economic incentives that are going to be required? Like what needs to shift here to create that demand and justify things from an economic standpoint? Because I think that seems to be the biggest question at this point.
You're absolutely right that the business model is... You know, when people talk about existential threats to the journalism and media world, there's a lot of it has to do with the polarization or the lack of embrace of facts. The real existential, the first part of the existential crisis has been the breakage of the economic model, mm-hmm. right? So this is what you're getting at. So in the old days, it was very ad driven. And that could be not just print, but broadcast, you name it. It was advertising, paid the freight. By and large, the advertising market blew up in the mid 2000s, just in general for media. Again, too many choices. Tech was much faster. Some of the experience was better, to be honest. And so advertisers didn't want it anymore, or the dollars turned to pennies on the advertising side. So now we've moved toward asking the audience to pay more subscription, right? So now that didn't go all the way there because can't ask people to pay too much. Plus you get subscription fatigue because subscriptions for your local news is also competing with subscriptions for Netflix or mm-hmm. whatever. And so, you know, streaming, whatever. So now there's a third leg of the stool. And the point I bring this up is that you don't have to abandon. It's not, I'm one of my big themes on your show today will be, let's get away from false choices. It does not always an either or. So advertising is way not what it used to be, but it's not gone. Mm-hmm. Reader revenue, whether that is membership, subscriptions, however, you know, that if it's worth something, you should pay something for it. $5 a month, $10 a month, whatever it might be. And then the third leg of the stool that is now being kind of warmly embraced, but it's relatively still new, is philanthropy. And so philanthropy is now the other component of the economic model, Levon, where you got advertising revenue, you got people paying for a subscription because they find value in it. And I don't blame people for, like, I'm not paying because it's not interesting enough or vital enough for me. That's, we'll get back to that in down the road here. But if there's value, people should pay something for it. And then the third thing being, and then local as well as national and even beyond philanthropy, whether it's the, you know, kind of the NPR model, membership or donation campaigns, whether it's big grants, big funders who care, whether it's companies in your respective cities that want, that believe in a healthy information ecosystem and want to bankroll out of corporate responsibility.
Well, just to maybe interject here, corporate responsibility is an interesting topic, but how do you maintain journalistic integrity if at the same time you're chasing big donors?
It's the same issue we've always had. So before we were chasing big dollars from Macy's or from big companies. They were advertising, and we always, those of us in the independent press, always had the language built in. You don't get to say what the editorial content is. You don't get to influence that. You can take issue if you think it's wrong. You can have letters to the editor like everybody else if you think the opinions are off. But you build those safeguards, those guardrails into the relationship. And if the people don't want to fund it unless they can say editorial, then you have to walk away from that money. Don't do it.
So this, this is separate of the arrangement that the Washington Post has with Jeff Bezos, for instance.
I'm sorry.
This is separate of the relationship that the Washington Post has with Jeff Bezos, for instance, correct?
I think it's an apples and oranges thing. But we can talk about Bezos in a minute. He's the owner. But ultimately, the Washington Post is still trying to get money from... Bezos is not fun in that Washington Post solo. There's advertising all over that website and then their print edition and all of that. So they have those relationships. Now, what he has provided for them, now obviously in high collision, is the notion that you could go years and years losing money, and he had the wherewithal and the ego play or whatever prompted him to buy the Post to fund that gap.
He sponsors his podcast, so we'll have to cut that piece out that you just said. No, he doesn't. I mean, I think it's a timely question.
Here's how I took that bait. He sponsored your podcast. That son of a gun. Oh, could you introduce me?
Yeah. It's part of his like true like bottom of the barrel charity efforts. But Bezos did just release new guidelines for the Washington Post last week, where now he is leaning on the scales a bit to ensure that the opinion pages are only going to focus on the pillars of personal liberties and free markets.
So let me give you what I hope is a more textured and view of that. So first of all, like everybody else, I'm like, nah, that's disappointing. Okay, so I get that. But let's also not be naive about a lot of things. So again, news organizations, I think we built around Bezos a romance that reflected our desire that the billionaires somehow save the news industry, and they must be good guys because why else would you get into...
Some of us built that romance. I see your point. Okay. Some of us.
Count me among them. Yeah. Okay, I confess to a romance. If we only had billionaires owning all our news organizations.
Yes. Yeah.
John Henry in Boston or Bezos in Washington and Sun Shang in L.A. And Buffett used to own the Buffalo News. And these guys care about free expression and independent journalism, and they'll save us. And for a little while, they did in that way I just described, where publicly traded news organizations were being whittled down because the shareholders, who didn't have any of that romance, wanted a return on their investment. And so the Gannett's of the world or McClatchy's, whatever it may be, or Sinclair in the broadcast space, whatever it is, they started cutting down the journalism because it wasn't making a profit. And the Bezos was allowing the runway of, you don't have to make a profit. In fact, you immediately don't even have to break even. Of course, people forget that Amazon lost money for decades before it started becoming the behemoth it is. So anyways, but to get back on point here. So it always was his newspaper. He was the owner, just as it was the Grahams before that. And for the longest time, including standing up to the president of the United States and his the current president's first term, he stood up to Trump, and they were at odds the whole time. So maybe we could be forgiven for thinking, he sees himself in a different kind of lane. And what it turns out, as we saw with Bezos, Zuckerberg, and all of them, not that I was completely surprised, but to the degree I was surprised, deciding that they needed to placate the incoming new president and change their tune. But what they're basically were telling us is that you didn't understand their tune to begin with, that they are libertarians, that they are capitalists, and that ultimately they might give you some runway before they want to turn a profit or want to put their thumb on the scales of the opinion pages. But the reality is, seriously, big corporations have owned news organizations for years and always did that. I grew up in Chicago. Andre, you're in Chicago, right? Right. The Chicago Tribune, you're in the greater Chicagoland area. The Chicago Tribune was owned by the McCormick family. They had a very, very I think for 100 years, they never endorsed a Democrat, always a Republican. And their editorial posture was very conservative. And then they let the news pages do whatever the news pages needed to do and tried not to influence that too terribly. The Wall Street Journal has Murdoch as an owner. The editorial page is has one very, very specific outlook on the free markets, capitalism, whatever it may be, and the news pages operate with some independence. I think I'm not naive about it. Some of that tends to bleed over. I get it. But all I'm saying is that Bezos's decision is completely compatible with a history of the publisher owner decides what they want to do. Now, in the case of, say, the Harris endorsement, just like that out in LA, the sinister part of all of that wasn't the decision. It was the timing of the decision. If a year or two before you wanted to say, we're not doing endorsements anymore, we think they're bad for trust or bad for the audience, I personally would disagree with that hugely. But you would get it. All right, you're the owner. You don't think that that's good business. Fine, own it. But to do it a month before an election or 11 days or whatever, I forget what the thing was, that seems reflexive to a political environment.
Right? Well, unless we forget the allegations made by the Bernie Sanders campaign in both the 2016 and 2020 elections that the Washington Post was heavily skewed in how it covered his campaign versus other Democratic candidates, Democratic Party candidates. So, I mean, I would make the case this issue, it's a systemic issue of a billionaire owning a newspaper. And it sounds like maybe some of the revenue models that you're discussing is trying to diversify that ownership structure by also leaning heavily on the subscription model to round out some of that philanthropy or money coming in from these sources of influence that may be able to tip the scales a little bit towards a certain position.
Well, I'm not so sure. I think there may be separate issues. Mm-hmm. So I do. Again, I think that, look, at, as I said, Bezos can decide what he wants to do with his property. I don't think the need for philanthropy is to offset that. It's not gonna. Mm-hmm. I do think, in fact, I would say that the billionaire owned companies, and again, I think you have to put in TV as well, and that those, that's one thing, and then you have the economic models for those not owned by billionaires. So the ones not owned by billionaires, they're the ones that are going to be relying more on philanthropy. They're the ones that need to diversify because they got no basic, you know, savings account in the way of a billionaire who can save their bacon if things go badly. I don't think there's anybody at the Post who can raise money to counter whatever it is Jeff Bezos wants to do. They can't. It's his. He's going to do it. What I would say, and you have to hope for, is to take his announcement where he said, because you know, the pillars of personal liberty and free markets, okay, that's fine. If But then free markets would be free expression. It would be a lot of things that it can't just be a couple of buzzwords that give you cover for placating the current administration. That's the current administration, in my view, which is claiming that a lot of independent journalism is censorship. Well, that's both inconsistent, hypocritical, and also not very free markety. So, I mean, people seem to want to have all these things multiple ways. So, again, I think Bezos and the billionaires out in LA as well, these are different. They're kind of conflating some things. I think they have a political, they have decided that their business interests should not be in collision with the party in power right now. And they should own that more openly than they do. That back to trust and transparency, you'd be better off just to say that and sort of to do that. But meanwhile, I have to look to the pages, the news pages of the Washington Post, of which I still think there's a good staff, a lot of talented journalists, same in the LA Times, same at the Boston Globe, papers owned by billionaires, whatever, and say, all right, let's watch their coverage. Is it as robust? Is it as fair? Is it as provocative as it should be? If you start to see, you know, a sense that editorial judgments have now been, you know, kind of calculated based on politics, that would be more disappointing than that the editorial pages are going to reflect the passions or the interests of the publisher.
Okay. So I guess there's a question of, you know, bias in journalism, and then there's a question of, like, regardless of the bias, how they can compete with the likes of Joe Rogan and content creators these days. You know, like, there's a lot of asymmetry here because they're held to different standards, right? So that's one problem. And I was brainstorming, like, how can we try to mitigate some of this? And I ran across the idea of using prediction markets to score journalistic reliability and then track their performance over time. And then you can kind of, you know, you can see over time, like, people aren't betting much for Joe Rogan to have the accurate kind of estimation of things versus the New York Times. What do you think about, like more concrete, like, systemic changes or new technologies or kind of frameworks to help us combat what seems like is, it just seems perilous at the moment, right?
Yeah.
It just seems like the content creators are obviously, given human nature, given the algorithms, you know, outrage, fear mongering, hijacking the brainstem type of stuff. It just seems like there's a huge gap here that I don't see how you overcome it without something significant.
Levon, you have definitely taken us down to a very dark, dark place.
he's the resident. That's what he does.
Not because you're wrong. I guess it's dark because you might be right. But I guess, you know, again, I kind of want to break things down to much more smaller parts as a way out, as a way to climb out. So first of all, I would say when you have the kind of audience that Joe Rogan has in terms of size, consistency, and all of that, I would argue that Joe Rogan is increasingly traditional media, right? So then now, look what I just did there. I just shot up our trust number, boom, because he's got a following, because that's media and people trust him. What I think I want to work on, both as a journalist, person who runs an institute on journalism, and to, you know, talking to guys like you who care, is like, how can we break this down to what specific audiences want and need, so that we get away from that. If you listen to Rogan or you listen to NPR, for that matter, that's the only thing you're going to do and the only judgment you're going to make. It's not that simple, nor is it that kind of either or binary, whatever word you want to use, because depending on what you get or what you want. I mean, I saw some item today. We actually had it in our Pointer Report newsletter, which I urge you to all sign up for. that Stephen A. Smith might run for president, or, you know, there's some talk about, you know, that, now, of course, that's patently absurd. But the reality is that there's another media personality that people get either their sports news from or their social news from or whatever. I get news from TikTok. I happen to like TikTok a fair bit. And I think the storytelling form is a good one. It's short. But it's never going to be my only form. Now, you know, I may be in that elite realm in terms of the path I came up. So I don't mean to say it, but I am saying that if we could break down the sort of service to people, I hope that's not a terrible word. Like, what provided a service? And service could be, I was entertained. That was useful. I found out where to go get my vaccination. I found out where to go get tickets to Cubs game, whatever it may be, and what I could rely on, and all of these things roll up into our media diet, then maybe we don't have to get into like the everything is the future of democracy, or everything is facts. Or you break it down into ways like, well, this fact really did work for me.
Hold on though. I think you're viewing it with a lot of like nuance, and you're kind of projecting maybe how you interpret those different media sources. But I think most people, I think it's actually highly predictive of, like, if you consume Joe Rogan, you're probably consuming other podcasts as well that are like similar in nature. And certainly the algorithms are promoting similar type of content to your feed. And if you're hearing Joe Rogan, you know, every day talk about how traditional media is trash and you can't trust them, like, I understand that some people are going to have a more nuanced take, but a lot of people are just, they're busy. They're listening to Joe Rogan at work. And then, like, over many years, like, you're going to get, you know, because of the familiarity bias and all that, just because he seems like a down-to-earth guy. He seems genuine, and he may be genuine, but he could be completely disastrously wrong. You're going to still, just as a human being, just because of human nature, you're going to start trusting him over New York Times. Not to say New York Times has covered themselves in glory, you know, but it's just I do think it's actually more binary than you're making it out to be, unfortunately. Like, it shouldn't be, but it is. And to be clear, like, I used to listen to Joe Rogan a lot, like, every day at work. I basically listen to all his podcasts. But then, like, you know, I kind of had the luxury and, I don't know, just a curiosity to kind of branch out. And so I've never gotten stuck in, like, one mindset, but a lot of people have. That's my concern.
Yeah. So I actually accept your pushback on, maybe I'm projecting here, maybe it's nuanced in that sense. So I don't dismiss that for a second. I do think, though, this is all about a long game to some degree. So first of all, you used to listen to Rogan all the time. Now you're not as much anymore. I think some of the folks, some of the audience you describe, they're already there. And the idea, you know, I have a saying, you know, create, don't convert. You're not going to suddenly, oh, you're all right about Joe Rogan or something like that. I think the key is to, how do we get people to diversify? And that's a long game. It's not, to your point, I get the nuance right away. I live it day in and day out. But I do think it could be guests on Rogan. It could be partnerships. I think we should get together with the Rogans of the world and sort of say, you have an audience. Let's not be afraid of, you know, like, it's just the other side. But what I will say this, and this is going to get like potentially super wonky, but I think it's important, is the concept of media literacy and getting to people at a very young age so that they can start to develop some of the muscles that require, you know, critical thinking, again, diverse sets of information sources. You learn this stuff early on so that eventually, look at the reason that people started to connect with Rogan and then it morphed into more was, it was entertaining, you know? And if when I bring up something like TikTok, I'm like, well, I didn't start getting news on TikTok, but it was funny. It was interesting. And now I've got some news too. And there's some good people on there as well as a lot of crap on there as well. Rogan has good guests sometimes, right? You know, I mean, Rogan, these guys, Rush Limbaugh, these are not dumb guys by any means. So I don't have an easy answer to throw back at you about that, except that, again, I don't think that saying it's a lost cause. Now, if you want to go back to something that could balance that diet out, this is maybe where your first question about AI helps. Hmm. Well, if I got some of my little rundowns via news summaries via AI, which ironically might have scraped the New York Times and gotten the information from there, I'm not going to buy the New York Times if I'm a Rogan guy, but I listened to Rogan for something. I heard something that I might have heard 50% that was bullshit and 50% that was might be some rooted in something. And now I'm getting a little bit more of a sophisticated take. But I think the idea of, pushing an us and them sort of narrative around it isn't going to be the answer either. I go back to value and service. If people find value in Rogan, fine. Can we have them find value in some other things too? Well, we in the journalism business have a challenge there. We better market it better. We better show them. We better give it to them in some form. If they like podcasts, they're never going to the New York Times. So then give them a different podcast to go with Rogan. Don't tell them. I don't believe scolding the audience is an answer either, frankly.
I don't mean to be scolding people. I'm just, although
no, you're being
maybe I am a little bit. I don't know. That's okay. I'm okay doing it a little bit.
It seems to come to you naturally.
What can I say?
What I really mean is, I get you're just sort of making sure we got a reality check here. That these folks are acting and behaving that in a certain way. That's fine, but unless you want to write them off, you think the answer isn't going to be to convert them. You're going to have to create some other things that appeal to them as well.
I was just going to say, Andre, the nature of what has to compete with the likes of Rogan or the likes of like a TikTok format of content, it's almost invariably going to be less nuanced in a time where I think we need more nuance. So I just see the technological and the economic incentives are at the moment extremely counterproductive. Like we're not going in the direction that we should be. Like you're kind of saying, well, you want to play the long game, that we want to diversify, but all the evidence seems to point that we're going in the opposite direction of becoming less nuanced, more tribal, and more beholden to the algorithms and our economic incentives.
Sure and no.
Okay.
Hell yeah. Okay.
So sure, again, if you're going to talk at that macro level, I can tell you there's probably 200 brand new news organizations that started up this year. 160 to 200 this year, as in the last 12 to 14 months. They're at a local level and they are very community oriented, right? Now, that's not to say instead of Rogan, but what Rogan is talking about is not what the communities that are being served by URL Media, which has a number of sites for communities of color in New York and around in New England, and has maybe 10,000, not 10 million, 10,000 digital subscribers, and gets some grant money and gets a little advertising and basically helps people figure out where they ought to put their kids in school in Brooklyn or whatever it may be and all of that. Now, here's the point. They're not competing with Rogan because it's two different things. Mm-hmm. What they are doing is, I'm going to get you some local information. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get you to trust local, have a relationship with some folks. Now, if you still want to listen to Rogan on other stuff, that's fine. But maybe if you start down here at a local level, you'll grow into some different sources, not just Rogan or not just TikTok, whatever it may be. And you start to build it out. And so what you're describing, of course, is completely true. If the only topic is Trump vaccines or, WWE, whatever it may be. But if you're talking about a lot of other shit too, including like sports or entertainment or local concerts or restaurants, now suddenly, you might become a wider news consumer. And yes, that's the long game optimistic faith I have that if you start to build some of those other muscles, then you won't put all your eggs, you know, on Sean Hannity or Joe Rogan or Rachel Maddow for them.
Yeah, I think, Neil, you bring up a very good point. And I mean, just because Joe Rogan moved to Texas doesn't mean all of a sudden he's covering like issues at Texas at the level of like county government or something like that.
Not even close.
I think that in many of the discussions we have, oftentimes our show delves with like really deep, like existential topics. Like, oh my God, like unregulated AI deployment, like these things that when you think about them at this like very, very 30,000 foot view level, are very terrifying and hard to grapple with in terms of how to start solving them. So oftentimes we kick around this idea of like, well, maybe the way that we resolve some of these existential threats humanity is facing is to think about it within the prism of the local community, the grassroots, like the county politics prism of things, right? Is that, sure, we can't compete with the likes of, I don't know why we keep on like mentioning Joe. There has to be another podcast out there. But with the likes of like a Joe Rogan type platform, if we're talking about vaccine skepticism or whatever hot button issue, but we're not really looking at it from a standpoint of how to make it most relevant to the community that the listener is in. That if there was this rich pool of information directly relevant to the issues I'm facing on my city block or in my ward, that is going to impact me far more than whatever the national, supranational types of conversations are being had.
Yeah, I mean, I think another way to think about it without, again, I hope doesn't sound too boring because I'm not talking about, you know, like buying a washer dryer, but I do think of consumerism as an angle, like as think about it from a consumer level, okay. Consumers of information, consumer. So that's why I go back down to, you know, and I don't mean just like the city council stuff, though that's vital too, but your taxes are how much you pay, right? I mean, it's about money. Your health, COVID was ultimately, we can talk about, you know, just the unbelievable toll and all of that. Ultimately, it was a very local story, mm-hmm. right? And so people needed trustworthy sources. You know, there are other, if you want to go back to government and politics, there are other people on the ballot other than Trump. And, or Trump and Harris. And that sort of matters. And some of this shit.
It matters, but the truth is most people didn't know anyone else that was on the ballot, right? Like, so, there's a role of like the local sphere of things, but I mean, I just don't see even long term. Like how you use that as an avenue to start to deviate from the likes of Rogan, because you need competition at the scale of Rogan to sway people to,
But this might be an apple and oranges conversation. This might be a conversation of, yeah, like you're going to be listening to Rogan because you're at work and you need to do something. But when it comes to other outlets, like other necessary points of information need, you're going to tune into something a little bit more locally flavored. And from what Neil is saying, it sounds like maybe there is a resurgence of sorts approaching that local tier media industry.
Well, I'd like to think there's a resurgence. I mean, it's going to be, it's small and slow, but it's real. Again, maybe it is apples and oranges. It's not about like, you know, just because we had that speech last night with the president, and the truth is like, well, do you think the country's going in the right direction or the wrong direction? These are kind of like the poll questions you had with untrust. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I bring up these kind of big indicators, but if I was to say like, Levon, do you think that the city of Kansas City is doing better this year than it did last year? I have no idea, by the way. I think I told you guys when I met, I've never actually been to the city. I'm looking forward to going. I have a number of good allies there. But that question is a different one. And I don't, you might decide that the who's in the president's chair makes all the difference, but do you trust the Kansas City Star or do you not? That's the media question I want you to ask. Or the local TV station, doesn't have to be the old Metro. Or a couple of websites.
Well,
again, the answer would still be no, and trust may be shit.
No, but what I'm saying is it almost it almost doesn't matter because of how little weight is put on it to begin with. That's what I'm saying. I don't know how you put more weight on the local, even though it obviously impacts you more in certain ways. But people are, I think it's kind of a status thing, a human nature thing. Well, people are drawn towards, like, you know, the best athletes, the best musicians, and the grandest politicians. And it's hard to take our attention away from that as, like, status seeking beings, and beings that are interested in status. Like, it's hard to take that focus away from the top of the pyramid and start looking at the base, even though the base is the thing that's holding up the rest of the pyramid, right? And so I don't know how you really deal with that from a human nature kind of psychology standpoint, but also I think there is still relevance with the top down kind of impact that you can have from the federal government, from, you know, focusing on the national level issues, because you talked about media literacy, and it's like, okay, well, if we want to revise the education system so that media literacy is part of the curriculum and people are equipped to kind of handle this new diverse media landscape, then, you need to make those changes at the national level, I would think. Maybe not in every case, but that would be certainly the quickest. And I think ultimately you would need it at a national level, because if certain states do it, that's great. But, you know, you've got all the states voting for, you know, government officials. So
I think the national level is the last place you want to do it. I think, you know, you need to go state by state, because you're not, because, you know, it's just going to be culturally too different. So, for instance, we do a program called MediaWise. Go to pointer.org and you'll see it's we did it with Stanford University, came up with a curriculum. And here's the thing. It's working with kids at the middle school and then slightly older level. With them, they get to have their phones, right? And we teach them how to, when you see stuff on your phone, online, on a social feed, here's how you check whether it's real or not. By the way, it doesn't have to be politics, doesn't have to be, it could be entertainment, could be anything, but you start to build the muscles of basically critical thinking.
Is right? It, you go to politifact.com?
That'll do it, maybe. That's another good source. And by the way, that's a breakdown. Politifact.com and our truth meter. That's just a gimmick. It's a great gimmick, but but accessibility is a useful technique. In any event, we always show our sources. And that's, by the way, another difference with AI. We always show you where you get information. You can decide for yourself. We get these kids to think about it using their phone, just to have just some sense of skepticism about what they hear and start to grow it. Now, there's going to be school boards in this country right now that are going to say, get that out of here, right? Because for the same, now that's the national debate at a local level, right? Or, you know, we don't want that book, you know, in the class. So there's going to obviously be tension, and it's a time of great tension. And I'm not naive about that. I may be, unusually optimistic. Is that different than naive? I don't know, but it's sort of one and the same. But I do think that, I don't think you can be, if you start dictating from the national level, that's where the Rogans play. That doesn't do us any good. But the whole point is there's got to be some new and different forms to get information. And a lot of times, I mean, this is a challenge in our media journalism space. Maybe you don't call it media literacy or journalism or something like that. It's just about how do you get information? And we take away some of the language that has become a little bit kind of, you know, I don't know, frame, we've lost the narrative, like, you know, which definitely all we do is say
that it's really damning that we can't call it media literacy. Damning.
I think that's certainly your best point, actually. If you can't call it that, then it's clearly, but right. But I do believe that you got to be able to come at things, you know, when you hit a wall, go around, don't come around a different way. Come on, man. Don't give up.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess for me, I'm looking at this from a more like time sensitive standpoint, and I'm thinking, well, in a matter of a decade or even half a decade, you've got people like Rogan who've made a massive impact, and it's like, sure, maybe if we just had an infinite amount of time, like over time, the grassroots efforts and all that would pay off, but in the meantime, you know, we've got Trump doing his thing. I mean, we'll see what happens. I mean, even like, I mean, just to speak to that, actually, I mean, I consider myself a little bit more involved in politics than the average person, you know, maybe someone who's who tries to be a little bit more careful with the information he consumes. But even I'm like, I don't know how much of this is an exaggeration, like how worried I should be. Like, I don't know what the hell's going on. Like, and it's just like, what would you say to me? Like, what would you say to give me
calm him
some hope? Yeah.
What'd you say?
I said, calm him. But
calm him. Well, go to, first of all, you had the first answer. Go to politifact.com and that'll help you some, you know, and again, and don't go there and believe everything we write either, but at least you'll see where we got it from. Never an anonymous
source. Who politifacts the politifact, right? It's
well, yeah, the, you know, the powers that be. Increasingly, we're fact-checking pundits and stuff like that, not politicians, you know, because people don't get their information from politicians. Anyway, so I do think you can find sites where independence is valued, where the sources are very, are always, we're transparent about them. You might not like them. We can link to the original source stuff. I mean, you know, one of the challenges in this environment, again, let's not focus on Rogan necessarily or even his audience. But one of the challenges in this environment is, you know, the recipient has some obligation to do a little work, you know, and I don't think we should. I think we in the journalism field get a little bit, you know, like, well, we don't want to offend the audience. You know, no, read the damn thing or pay some attention or watch the whole video or don't just accept a soundbite.
I agree. People should. But... people don't. They don't do anything. Yeah, people don't do. Oh, most people. So Andre would probably to a certain extent. But
is
like,
this projection, Devon? Is this?
It might be projection. You know, but Neil was doing it earlier, so I get to do it. No, but like most people just aren't. They're not going to go check sources. They're not going to read the whole article, right? And so you mentioned this earlier, and I think it's interesting. You know, the TikTok is presenting content in a narrative format. Like or those are the most engaging TikToks anyway. Maybe that's a clue of, okay, the journalistic landscape has to shift towards figuring out how to deliver the content that is consumable in the way that most people are consuming their information, which is now, you know, primarily through social media and content creators. And that sort of format. I mean, there's no reason why, you know, like the New York Times. I mean, and they started doing this. Like Ezra Klein started a video podcast recently,
right.
You know, in addition to the audio podcast. Because audio podcast is great. It reaches a lot of people, but even more people, obviously, with video. And it's like, well, okay. I mean, that's a start. I don't know. That's just throwing that out there.
But. At last, I agree with everything you just said. Seriously, I do think that why the Rogans and others emerged is that they came up with new and different forms that people found more useful or compelling than a very traditional sort of work. And I do think that this is where the trust will go into the trust question that we started the whole show with is going to be like, well, it's not so much the what, but the who, just so I know where it's coming from. But then the form, like you just described, whether it's TikTok, whether it's video podcasts, YouTube channels in general, these influencers, they are telling stories in a very, very good and effective way. And I think the so-called traditional media would do well and is more increasingly doing this, which is to partner with them or to adopt some of those things, recognizing that there's three people on this call and we might all have a different form we prefer. So you better come up with all three kinds. And again, maybe that's where AI is a helper, you know, to sort of, you know, save some resource in it. Or there's some other new tech. And there's going to be something that's going to be a year from now that we didn't even think of. And so I do think that not taking for granted the audience and their time, the way they process information. I mean, you know, here's an interesting thing is that, you know, years ago, when it was, you know, when he was really at the height, the journalism world was always like lamenting, even as they respected Jon Stewart. Like, what? I can't believe more people get their news from The Daily Show. It's on Comedy Central. He's the first to say he's not a journalist. And so we could lament that, even as we all watched it and a lot of us enjoyed it. Or you could sort of say, like, well, what is it about the way he's given them information that they now, and guess what? If they got their news from The Daily Show, they got their news. You know, I think we should embrace that as people who care about people being informed. Hopefully he's getting it right. I do believe even point of view journalism can be fact-based as long as you show where you're from and all that. And so I bring that up as a bit of an old school view, but in a sense that humor can be part of it. Brief can be part of it. The gimmick I said with PolitiFact, it's a gimmick, but it works because if you want more, you can get it, but you're not forced to take more. And all along, we want to respect, and it's up to you to decide what you, the audience member, what you want to do with it. You don't have, we're not trying to tell you. And so I think, Levon, the way to kind of bring our two worlds together is breaking it down into some new and different sources. Acknowledging that different people are going to get it different ways. And so you're going to have to come up with some compelling ways to do it because people do have a ton of choices and they're not going to do it because you told them it's good for them.
Yeah. In summary, we need more gimmicks. So there we go.
We need more good gimmicks.
Jazz hands and hoverboards. That's what's going to save us. Yeah.
That's right. Exactly. If it works, I'm about results, man.
Andre, anything else that you wanted to cover?
I think we got a lot out of this conversation. I think maybe to dilute the doomerism a little bit, Neil, to close things out, could you tell us a little bit about something that has made you optimistic in your kind of 30,000 foot view of the media industry or the biz from where you sit? What has given you renewed hope or has excited you?
So a couple of things, I guess I'd say. Just last year, finished my 9th year, and now I'm out because I was term limited as a member of the Pulitzer Prize board. So I saw lots of really cool journalism, of which there's still like some kick-ass investigative work going on. And even as we talked about, you know, that challenge of growing the, you know, sort of next generation of journalists who can't afford maybe rich schools. There's just some really cool video work and lots of young people still getting into business. Lots of young people, you know, the one thing about this current climate is there is a sense, even as there is anxiety about a polarized future and an administration currently that goes out of its way to attack the media, there is just, I think there is a sense, a lot of people do feel a sense of appropriate indignation. Mm-hmm. I don't think that there is a complacency about where we're at, even as people are sort of sorting it out. So I see a lot of good work around at a very local level. I said there are some good little small organizations coming to be. So that gives me some optimism. I do think that this growing connection between influencers and content creators and traditional journalists holds out hope where each will help each other. Mm-hmm. So that there'll be some guardrails around some of the content creation where at least you own your stuff. Just be, you know, we just want you to take some accountability for it. You don't have to, don't become boring. Don't become, think that the answer to credibility is to go back in time. I think that there's reason for hope to think that there's new forms and they were going to have some of the principles of honesty, openness, accountability, even if they're have a point of view, that's all cool. And meanwhile, I do think they are having a great impact on some traditional journalism to make it much more lively and interesting. So again, I see the audience, I think, will embrace it. Maybe not as fast as Levon would like, and I get that, but I think it's happening. You gave up the Ezra Klein example. I mean, you know, let's do some things that are, you know, let's double down on some things that are working, you know, and your very podcast is an example of let's talk to each other about this stuff and get kind of comfortable with it's going to be gray going to be.
We need more podcasts.
more podcasts that I say, like, embrace the gray. It's not going to be an easy yes or no, you know, if some of the more commercially successful.
Hey, I am all about the gray.
You are all about the gray, man. You carry that beautifully. You do carry that beautifully. So I don't know. I mean, I tend to think like new forms, new tech can work in our favor. Listen, it's a tough environment out there. There's a lot of journalists under a strain and duress, including some harassment. There are funding cuts in some areas that are going to affect the journalism model. But I do think that you got to have faith in people. Like, if you bring them something of value, something that gives them something that's interesting, and again, I want to include not just good for them, but entertaining or compelling. Audience interests are kind of boundless.
I agree. I finally agree with you as well.
Look, I got a smile at least.
Neil, where can people access the work of the Poynter Institute? Where can people follow you if they're interested in learning more about the work that you do?
So please go to poynter.org. We have a great newsletter, the Poynter Report. There's a podcast that goes with that every couple of weeks on media. You can get a hold of me at nbrown@poynter.org. I'm on LinkedIn as well. We're doing work on fact-checking, on ethics of journalism. People love talking about that, the decision, how the sausage is made, what's going on in the media. I do believe that we're doing a good job and we need to do more holding the media accountable. It's not just believe us just because. But Poynter.org is where you can find everything. And we're doing the media literacy work, media-wise. That's the future, man. That's the growth engine, is getting the folks on their phones early, learn new ways, and you'll even see some pretty cool memes there.
Memes. All about the memes. Yeah.
That's another form, man. That's
that's how I'm getting my news.
yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Neil. We appreciate you joining us. Perhaps we can check in about a year when all the dust settles and we figure out what exactly this brave new world is going to look like.
I look forward to it. You guys applaud the show. It was a great conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, man.